Blog Talk Radio.
And by virtue of the power and for the purpose aforesaid, I do order and declare that all persons held as slaves within said designated states and parts of states are and henceforward shall be free, and that the executive government of the United States, including the military and naval authorities thereof, will recognize and maintain the freedom of said persons. And I hereby enjoin upon the people so declared to be free to abstain from all violence, unless in necessary self-defense. And I recommend to them that, in all case when allowed, they labor faithfully for reasonable wages. And I further declare and make known that such persons of suitable condition will be received into the armed service of the United States to garrison forts, positions, stations, and other places, and to man vessels of all sorts in said service. And upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice, warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God.
This is Our Common Ground on Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you. And welcome on this Saturday night to Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, your host, and we thank you so much for being with us here on a Saturday night at Our Common Ground. We have put aside our Saturday night open mic because there's something very exciting that is going on in this country, and we wanted to bring it to you. For your upliftment, for filling in the blanks of hope. Some of us need filling in the blanks of hope. Tonight we're going to be talking about how there are people who are taking the case of U.S. political prisoners to the U.N. The core of our discussion tonight is the fight for human rights on every front. Earlier this year, Standish Willis, Ethio Wangaza, and others submitted a report to the United States Human Rights Commission through the leadership of Ajemu Baraka, who is the executive director, and the members of the board of the U.S. Human Rights Network. And later this year, they will be presenting that report to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. Their goal is to outline the string of human rights abuses related to political prisoners and political repression in the United States. This report was submitted. It is a stakeholders report to the Universal Periodic Review, which is a mechanism used by the UN to evaluate member states regarding adherence or the lack thereof to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and related treaties. Our guest, attorney Ifia Wangaza. She is a member of the U.S. Human Rights Network. She is a SNCC veteran, a longtime Black liberation activist, and an essential part of the leadership voice of the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the Back to Black organization. She is one of the co-authors of this report, the U.S. Human Rights Network's Cluster Report on United States Political Prisoners, State Repression, she is working to publicize the report, to raise the issues of political prisoners and human rights violations and the need for attention to them or these issues in the United States. Currently, she is recruiting more endorsers. Our Common Ground is pleased to be able to offer to be an endorser, and she's calling attention to these issues. She will also be making a presentation about the report and the issues of political prisoners in the United States at the United Nations in Geneva on November 5th, this fall, 2010. And we are so pleased to have her with us. We want to say good evening to those of you who are chatting it up in our chat room, and for those of you who are listening and you'd like to join in the discussion, you may do so later in the program, or you can join our chat room, which is located at blogtalkradio.com/OCG, to be able to come in our chat room to exchange and interchange, engage with those who are in our chat room. And we're pleased to see that some of our regulars have already arrived, Doc Don and Navaxar and Twee1968. We are real lucky to be able to talk with attorney Ifia Wangaza of the U.S. Human Rights Network. If you'll remember, we were talking to one of the staff members last year of the network, Kali Okuno, and we were talking about the numerous violations, especially around the issues of human rights violations that happened during and after the Katrina crisis in New Orleans, and we're real pleased. Let me tell you a little about their work. Underlying all human rights work in the United States is a commitment to challenge the belief that the United States is inherently superior to other countries of the world, and that neither the U.S. government nor the U.S. rights movements have anything to gain from the domestic application of human rights. The network members believe that the U.S. government should no longer be allowed to shield itself from accountability to human rights norms, and that the U.S. civil, women's, worker, immigrant, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, prisoner and other rights movements that stand to benefit, perhaps, now have more than ever from an end to U.S. impunity in this regard. We did talk extensively, and for those of you who would like to pick up on that interview with Kali Okuno, you can go to ustalknetwork.com, or you can go to www.ourcommonground-talk.ning.com and go to Our Common Ground Archives, and you can find that that interview. But we are just so pleased to be able to have attorney Ifia Wangaza of the U.S. Human Rights Network with us tonight, because I think that this is going to be another point of contention with this president, with this administration, to understand that there is more than the superficial, hear what I'm saying, superficial political talk about civil rights, about women's rights, about other rights in this country, that are just political banter. And I think that what we're going to be seeing is that the U.S. Human Rights Network is going to be forcing the issue with the U.N. For instance, I have always felt that what is happening to the Scott sisters in Mississippi, what happened with Oscar Grant, what happened with Troy Davis, have always been very specific human rights violations that have to, and we're going to talk with Ifia Juan Gaza about how some of those cases have to be a violation of the agreement signed on by the U.S. with the United Nations. Also, I want to tell you that the U.S. Human Rights Network was formed to promote U.S. accountability, and we'll be talking with Attorney Juan Gaza more about that, to promote accountability to universal human rights standards that we always talk about. You know, we're always saying that we're a country going somewhere to build democracy, when in fact we haven't built a democracy here. We had a national election stolen by a court that is supposed to be the Supreme Court of the United States. So the network also works toward connecting the U.S. human rights movement with the broader U.S. social justice movement and human rights movements around the world. And I particularly think that it's the way to go. It's absolutely the way to go, because as long as we are standing on something that was created in isolation of a universal human rights movement, we're standing in isolation. Before I bring Attorney Afia Juan Gaza on, I want to share with you an interview that was conducted with the director of the U.S. Human Rights Network, Ajemu Baraka, because I think that what he shares in this interview is real important. And at the bottom of this, we'll be talking with Attorney Afia Juan Gaza. Thank you again for being with us. You're listening to Our Common Ground, and this is Ajemu Baraka, the Executive Director of the U.S. Human Rights Network.
Today, the General Assembly voted the U.S. on to the Human Rights Council. What do you think that means for the work of the council?
I think that this is an important addition to the council because of the fact that the U.S. government has played a crucial role, historical role, in the creation of the Human Rights Commission that was reformed and replaced by the Human Rights Council. And in that sense, it is important to have the U.S. On around the table and as part of the highest UN human rights body. On the other hand, it also important to stress that this is just the beginning for the U.S. re-engagement with international bodies, with human rights bodies, and we have not yet seen the Obama administration responding and fully addressing the key human rights issues, especially domestic human rights issues.
Well, how did you respond to the argument on part of some elements in the U.S. that the Human Rights Council is basically irrelevant, that to bring the prestige of the U.S. to the council was to waste the prestige of the council because the council basically is irrelevant and compromised?
I think it is a matter of a political will. If the governments, and mainly the governments that are truly committed to human rights, can work together to improve and make the council more effective, that will happen. If there's no political will and the council will remain a forum where the countries will not take seriously human rights commitments, then this will be a disregarded and discredited council. I think the U.S. government has to come to this council with a good faith and an open to ideas and respect other countries' suggestions on how to make the council more effective, And more importantly, the U.S. government has much to do under the Obama administration to improve U.S. credibility and reputation in the world. And I think a good first step would be to look at incorporate human rights into domestic policy. And that's something that is an area that has not seen a lot of action by the Obama administration yet.
Well, on that issue of credibility, some people have raised the concern that it appears that even under the Obama administration, that the U.S. still is attempting to pick and choose where it will engage the international community. As we know, the administration did not come to Geneva for the Durban review process because of various issues we won't get into here. But the argument is that if the U.S. is reluctant to engage in difficult conversations, tackling difficult issues, with the possibility that it might decide to disengage and perhaps even leave the table of conversation, that the U.S. occupying this seat is risky. How do you respond to that?
I think that, again, the U.S. government has made a decision to join the council. It made a decision and made a pledged and made commitments, human rights commitments, to that it made. We think that those commitments were inadequate. We think that there's much more to be said about U.S. action and U.S. commitment, particularly to honor its international human rights commitments and treaty obligations. I think that the U.S. government has in a way, in the very beginning, and the Obama administration has not sent a clear message as to how they want to respond to a number of human rights issues, including domestic human rights issues. We have seen it in the area of national security, where notwithstanding the commitment to close Guantanamo and end torture, we have not seen enough on the accountability level, on the side of holding officials accountable to human rights standards, and particularly on the engagement of the U.S. government in torture. We have not seen enough on what the U.S. government will do with regard to the rendition program and a number of issues. And also we have yet to see the U.S. government address key domestic human rights issues, like, for example, the establishment of enforcement and monitoring mechanisms, ratifying human rights treaties that have not been ratified or even signed by the U.S. government.
Well, let's stay with that for a minute. We are very much concerned about the domestic human rights scene. And you mentioned that with the U.S. rejoining the council, that will, in fact, strengthen domestic human rights. What way will that strengthen the advocates within the U.S.?
I think if people in the United States should hold the U.S. government accountable to its international commitments, and those the human rights rhetoric that is being used abroad should be used as a way to shed light on domestic human rights crises and problems. And for example, on the Gulf Coast, the lack of a full comprehensive human rights approach to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina and Rita is an issue that is yet to be taken up by the Obama administration. We have not seen yet the response to the immigration rates and the number of issues, including the problems in the immigration detention and the abuses that are occurring there. So there's a number of burning domestic issues that we have not seen a strong human rights commitment. And what we say human rights commitment is that U.S. government will take a holistic approach to addressing those domestic civil rights, civil liberties issues, and using human rights as a way to promote and respect and protect people's rights on the number of issues. The stimulus plan, for example, has been at the center of the government's attention, and yet we haven't seen the stimulus plan used, or at least have not seen enough of how the U.S. government will be using that to promote full equality in the distribution of those funds, so that people who are disadvantaged, poor, and community of color would be receiving those funds and would be able to improve the quality of education, and as an example.
And for those of you who have joined us and you're in our chat room, I have posted a link to the report. The report is titled Political Repression Continuum of Domestic Repression. And it will be presented, it has been submitted, it will be presented in November 2010. And our guest tonight is one of the co-authors. She is a member of the U.S. Human Rights Network. She is a SNCC veteran, a longtime Black liberation activist, and an essential part of the Malcolm X grassroots movement and the Back to Black organization. She is the co-author of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and she is Attorney Afia Wangaza. Afia, thank you so much. I am so honored to have you with us tonight.
It is my honor and my pleasure, and we thank you so much for giving us an opportunity to share with the community and to raise the consciousness and the visibility of this issue and this opportunity. Thank you.
Well, you know, we did an in-depth discussion last year about the work of the U.S. Human Rights Network and talking about the specific treaties in which the U.S. has entered into with the U.N. And my impression coming away from that was that we really have not honored, and we really are in violation in so many places, and that we don't see it as a priority. Now, that was prior to the election of President Barack Obama. Tell us what the take is now about, with Susan Rice being in place as our UN ambassador. Has that changed?
We think so. In addition to Susan Rice being the ambassador to the UN, Barack Obama made her as UN ambassador, gave her cabinet member status as a way of expressing the significance that he said his administration would place on diplomacy, on foreign policy, and on relations with building relations with other countries. So we think that it is significant, and whether how useful it has or will be remains to be seen, even though we're 2 years into it. Susan Rice has been somewhat disappointing in her approach and her treatment, certainly of I would say of the Sudan, which is not without criticism itself. But it's not her approach has not been at all different from the Bush approach, as I must add has been the case with many aspects of the Obama administration. But we do think that there is an effort, conscious, deliberate effort at rapprochement to the international community, indeed, and rebranding itself. We think that the fact that on November 5th, 2010, the U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Attorney General Eric Holder will represent the United States in its first human rights compliance assessment by the Universal Periodic Review Working Group of the United Nations Human Rights Council is further evidence of some significance that the Obama administration is giving to to the rebranding, its role in the international community, and its participation in international vehicles. The review is also, to be noted, a public interactive dialogue between Clinton and Holder and member and observer states of the council based on reports submitted by the U.S. government, the U.N.'s Office of High Commissioner for Human Rights, and most notably, individual and organizational U.S. stakeholders. So that means that non-governmental organizations, as in the case of the U.S. Human Rights Network, will be able to put forth, in fact, indeed, we have filed a report, and we appreciate your linking to that report, a overarching report which includes 24 cluster reports which raise issues about the United States' failure to meet its constitutional, its own constitutional, as well as international human rights obligations. So it's an extraordinarily important important point. We will be submitting lobbying at this point, lobbying member states that will be examining the United States and attempting, as we have successfully done in the past, to have them to adopt issues and questions that we present and raise and challenge the United States on its failure to apply international standards and to meet those standards. So that in what is called the outcome document, which is prepared by the working group at the end of the review process, that these various issues will be included as recommendations, and those recommendations subsequently considered and adopted by the full Human Rights Council at a later session, become the standard by which the United States is evaluated by its peers, other countries, for years to come. And it's in that light, not only do we raise the 24 issues ranging from civil rights, the implementation of the Convention for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, corporate accountability, the criminal justice system, the application of the death penalty, disability rights, economic and social rights, education, access to meaningful education, environmental justice, foreign policy, housing rights. Anyone who saw the 30,000
Atlanta
in Atlanta on Wednesday, it's just clear.
Mm-hmm.
Not
I was going to ask you about that.
That 5 years after Katrina, nothing has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there is a report on the continuing aftermath of Katrina and internally displaced persons and the United States government's failure to allow people to return home and to assist in that effort. Labor rights, LGBT rights, macroeconomics, the planning, you know, the United States likes to pretend it's not a planned economy, it's a planned economy. And if nobody didn't believe that, the $1,500 billion that was doled out to the banks and the insurance companies to keep them functioning is proof positive of the planned nature of the U.S. economy. Migrant labor rights is an other cluster report, and it's called a cluster report because each report is the work of a coalition or collective of individuals and organizations doing work on those specific issues. Included is also a report on police brutality. Political repression is the companion and overarching report, which I solely prepared and is the companion report with the U.S. Political Prisoners, for which I co-authored with Stan Willis. Their reports on racial disparities in access to and enjoyment of health care, racial profiling, reproductive rights, right to work, and treaty ratification, or more accurately, the lack of treaty ratification by the United States. State repression, the continuum of domestic repression, and its legacy, which is COINTELPRO, civil rights era, political prisoners, prisons of war, and exiles, are the newest issues to be added to mainstream human rights work. And although there have been organizations and individuals that have gone to the United Nations and participated in international legal bodies before, including WCAR, the World Conference Against Racism, and raised the issue of political prisoners, this is the first time that a mainstream organization or an organization that is recognized and respected by mainstream human rights organizations, both within and without, as members and as allies, has made the issue of political prisoners, prisons of war, exiles in the United States a key issue, and highlighted the long, long history, as we know, of repression in the United States, and how the criminal justice system has been used as a mechanism for repression. So it's a really critical and important point in time. And as we, you know, we talk about it in as it relates to repression and as it relates to the resulting continued incarceration of people from over 40 years. Rochelle McGee has been incarcerated for over 45 years, the longest held political prisoner in the world. Is held in the United States, which, of course, incarcerates more people than any other country in the world. Unlike the Bush administration, which walked out of the 2001 UN Conference Against Racism, and Obama's failure to appear at the 2009 WCAR review, the U.S., as I said, will be present with cabinet-level representation at the UPR review. With Hillary Clinton and Eric Holder's presence suggesting or affirming the suspicion that the Obama administration sees the UPR as a useful form in which to advance its global charm offensive. Clinton, quote-unquote, elevating the role of diplomacy along with defense, close-quote, in foreign relations abroad, and Holder symbolizing, as an African, the embodiment of human rights enforcement at home. Together, they will, of course, attempt to maintain the myth of the U.S. as human rights standard bearer, and we intend to be there to point out that it's never held that position, and it should no longer be mythologized. Uh-huh. On one hand, recently, the United States lecturing African governments about corruption rather than acknowledging the continuing impact of colonialism, and on the other hand, recently holding a three-day young African leaders forum at the White House challenging them essentially to overthrow their elders and to set aside the lessons, the legacy of colonialism and the lessons learned from colonialism, by, as Barack Obama put it, to bring change to their countries by standing up for freedom, openness, and peaceful disagreement, close quote. It should be noted that not a single formal state representative, adult, elder, statesman was invited to participate in this Young African Leaders Forum and this exchange in which the United States sought to and seeks to woo African young leadership. Clinton and Holzer, we believe, have, and we know, in fact, have dealt with the issues of political prisons and state repression before. Holder, as Assistant Attorney General under Bill Clinton, processed the well-deserved commutation of the sentences of the 16 Puerto Rican independence fighters and two North American anti-imperialists. Hillary Clinton, then running for U.S. Senate from New York, initially then later withdrew her support for their commutations, but of course is well aware of the commutations and solicited the vote of the Puerto Rican community. Although it continues to hold out political prisoners, the Obama administration recently chided Cuba for its agreement to release 50 dissidents, professional dissidents paid by the United States. The United States expressed concern over so-called government repression in other countries, while it, of course, not only holds political prisoners, but denies their existence. It's demanded an investigation of Scotland's humanitarian release of Libya's Megrahi, the so-called Lockerbie bomber. It's privatized U.S. prisons on one hand, and on the other, allocated funds for, quote-unquote, more humane prison conditions for Afghan and Pakistani prisons within those countries in order to reduce, as they put it, the radicalization of inmates, which is a continuation of the Bush administration policy incarcerating rendition and incarceration of people outside of the United States for the purposes of avoiding constitutional and human rights scrutiny. It's the Obama administration has escalated the Bush administration's policy of withholding court-ordered documents and its crackdown on whistleblowers and journalists, most notably, of course, is getting a great deal of attention at the moment, is WikiLeaks and the threat of attempting to capture, kidnap, and render the editor-in-chief, Assange, I can't think of his first name at the moment, for their having released the documents of the criminal war crimes of the United States in both Iraq and Afghanistan. The other, which has received significantly less attention, was, of course, at the Republican National Convention, where journalists, up to 40 journalists, were arrested and held for the purposes of quashing bad publicity during the Republican National Convention, and among them was Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! She and members of her crew have filed a lawsuit against the city of Minneapolis, which was filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights in order to challenge this practice of using the criminal punishment system as a mechanism for quashing dissent. So as I started off saying, as we know, the United States has a long history of political repression, and it has a legacy of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles who are the result of that. And as a people for whom these persons have given the most precious thing of all, and that is their liberty, we have a duty to take those steps that are necessary to not only make them visible and the world aware of their existence, but to see that their sentences are commuted at a minimum to time served and that they are released immediately, unconditionally. We have a number of other demands that we are making, including the a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal and Lynette Peltier, as they have requested, as well as other demands that include implementation of the recommendations made by the Church Commission, or Committee, I'm sorry, which found that in the FBI's creation of COINTELPRO, which was a mutation of the Palmer raids, and which was a mutation of other such repression prior to the Attorney General Palmer becoming Attorney General, assigning J. Edgar Hoover to take up where he left off and the resulting COINTELPRO, that cycle, that practice, this pattern of repression is structurally dismantled and not transmuted and recurring. In addition to that would be the investigation of the murders of Fred Hampton, Mark Clark, and other political activists who were the targets of COINTELPRO and political repression in the United States. So it's a broad-ranging demand that with which the United States will be confronted on November 5th, and we need not only for us to be in Geneva raising these questions, but we need people around the country to be educating ourselves and being active, notably on November 5th, to appear at embassies, consulates of member states, to also that will be examining the United States and also federal buildings in the United States, demanding the commutation of the sentences of U.S. political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, and the immediate unconditional release. People in this country who have experienced human rights violations, we are urging to participate in what's called the Testify Project, which can be the link is on the U.S. Human Rights Network's website, but can be also located at www.testfyproject.com. So there's a lot of work for all of us to do. And none of it is as risky or burdensome as the people who have spent over 40 years in prison for us to be in a position that we can make this demand at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you about the council. When this report is presented before the Human Rights Commission of the UN, what is it expected to happen, especially specifically in regard to political prisoners, especially in regard to the human rights violations found after Katrina? And I do want to ask you about police brutality, because I think law enforcement has gone absolutely rampant in this country against especially African-American men, boys.
And the number of people who have been shot down in recent days, it's just unreal. And I frankly,
beyond the pale.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I think that the fact that that Barack Obama backs off the proper response that he initially had with the assault on Skip Gates has given the police and, law enforcement generally
permission.
Mm-hmm. Permission to just go buck wild.
Yep.
The council is a product of the United States' assault on the Human Rights Commission, which preceded the council, at the point wherein Libya became the chair. It was convenient for the United States to discredit and to demand that the council be dismantled on the grounds that at that point it hadn't been elected and wasn't likely to get elected to the commission. It having been successful at dismantling it, it of course has since been elected to the commission council, and you can see how, in some ways, how meaningless this, and on one hand, this switch up is, but on the other, it is quite significant, especially with the universal review process, which has wound up being much more significant than the United States thought that it was going to be because of its peer nature, and which is similar, very similar to the kind of power that individual countries had when the General Assembly, as opposed to the Security Council, was the key body for the United Nations. The Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights oversees the UPR process, and therefore it is the highest body, and actually at this point it's the most powerful because it is the most open, the most transparent, and has the potential of applying the greatest pressure, although that pressure is in essence one of shaming the various governments into performing its proper duties. The mm-hmm. council itself is comprised of 47 states region, with representation from every region, from the global north and south, the eastern and western hemispheres, all of the continents, the cross-class representation. So you have, in addition to technologically advanced countries, you have the developing countries. So it's a broad cross-section of countries that are actually involved in the sit on the council. Now, any government, any country can raise questions and ask questions, and that's what we will be wanting to do. We will be asking countries to question the United States on the existence of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, and what steps it is taking to restore them to society. Mm-hmm. Namely, that their sentences should be commuted and they should be reintegrated into society unconditionally and immediately. The United States has the right to reject recommendations and that are made in in what's called the outcome document. After the the public dialogue that occurs based on the reports made by the United States government, the report of the Office of the High Commissioner, and of U.S. stakeholders, individuals, and organizations, then the working group, which I believe we've already said sits in Geneva and is composed of the 47 regional members, prepares an outcome document with the recommendations. It is subsequently considered, the outcome document is subsequently considered and adopted by the Council at a later session. The United States will indicate which recommendations it supports or accepts, and these, among others, become the basis for future evaluations, which means that once we get the issues of state repression and the existence of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles on the list, then it remains on the list until the issue has been addressed. So that means that every 4 years when the United States appears for reevaluation, it has to answer the question of what is the status of these people and what have you done in order to restore them to society. So the that is also the case with the other various other treaties that the United States is bound by. The United States attempts to present itself as being exceptional in that it presents the U.S. Constitution to the world as it does to us as a human rights document rather than the commercial document that it is. And while in recent years there's been a great deal of attention and celebration that's gone on with so-called landmark events, the 50th anniversary of the Public Accommodation Act, the Voting Rights Act, at the same time, the protection and advancement of civil and human rights have declined amidst these great celebrations and displays of these landmark, so-called landmark events. The current environment has actually tended to be little more than a cover for law enforcement, which has grown increasingly more repressive and hostile to not only international documents, but to the U.S. Constitution, specifically amendments, the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and the 14th Amendment, even to this point where there's a serious effort to raise support for repealing the 14th Amendment, which doesn't just deal with the question of citizenship for those born in the United States, but other issues as well, including and most importantly, equal protection and due process. The United States continues to be true to its longer history of political repression and its use of the criminal justice system to quash dissent. It continues this tradition to date, and among other violations, it falls short in meeting its international human rights obligations as provided under the UN Charter, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the UN treaties. Native Americans can tell us that the United States has never signed a treaty that it's kept. And even more to the point, it's the United States continues to violate basic human rights that are protected in those treaties, UN treaties, which it has signed, meaning the International Convention to Eliminate All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as the Convention Against Torture and other cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment. So when we look at the United States and its conduct, this is a very important moment as we see the world making this intergenerational shift. After 50 years, we are in some senses back to where we were when African countries and other developing or formal colonies were coming, acquiring independence and attempting to assert their own authority and their own identity, and the United States enjoyed some impunity in light of the fact that it, unlike the French, the British, the Belgian, the Portuguese, and such, had not been hands-on colonial powers, and therefore was viewed with less suspicion and a great deal of openness. That kind of attitude is afoot in the world today, especially with the disarming air that comes from the election of Barack Obama, the first president of African descent in the United States, and of the old guard in developing countries getting old and dying off, and then new people coming in who, especially young people, who do not know the history of their own country and that country's relationship with
because these
other
issues really go back
countries.
to the Church Committee of 1976.
Exactly. That's right.
When the United States decided to distort and revise its own history of human rights and ignored many of the issues, the 24 points that you've been talking about tonight. I'm going to take a break. You are listening to Our Common Ground. We're talking with our guest, Attorney Ifeah Wangaza of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and we're talking about a report which has been submitted to the U.S. Council on Human Rights to challenge the United States on 24 points of human rights, potential violations, real violations, old violations. And for those of you who are listening, it's really interesting, Ifeah, to see some of the people. I know almost all 53 individuals on this list that have endorsed this report. Mm-hmm. And I want to ask you when we come back from break how many of them have been actively involved in the development of the report, people like Dr. Jeremiah Wright, who I love, Ramona Ortega, Jane Franklin, and for those of you who are listening, I really suggest that you go to the to www.ushrnetwork.org and read the report. If you look at Dr. Mutulu Shakur, the Leonard Pelletier Defense of Offense Committee, and Ben Carnes, and I have been friends for such a long time, Susan Gesch of the Human Rights Educator, Cliff Kelly, who is my colleague at WVON Talk, Peter and Barbara Clark of the Leonard Pelletier Defense Committee, Dr. Bob Starks, I haven't seen him or talked to him in maybe 4 or 5 years, Jacob Carruthers of the Center for Inner City Studies, Reverend Paul Jakes, just some of the individuals. And for those of you who are listening, I suggest that this is something that is so important that we have got to figure out how to force this administration to be better than what we have had to respond. And the other, when we come back from break, the other thing I want to ask you, Attorney Wangaza, is whether or not the U.S. Human Rights Network has had an opportunity to meet with the White House, to meet with the Justice Department, and to meet with Susan Rice prior to filing this report. You're listening to Our Common Ground, and we are at Blog Talk Radio. Later on in the program, we're going to give you an opportunity to join us in this discussion about U.S. issues of human rights, about the violations and the negligence to the issue. We're going to be talking about police brutality, immigration, and migrants. and the human rights issues surrounding those. Stay with us, won't you?
We must remember always that accusation is not proof, and that conviction depends upon evidence and due process of law. And remember that we are not descended from fearful men, not from men who feared to write, to associate, to speak, and to defend the causes that were for the moment unpopular. Cassius was right. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves. Good night, and good luck.
Up the entire African American community to the hidden issue of mental health.
It showed up in my life through one of my best friends, and we've been friends for over 30 years.
One story at a time.
If we would have known earlier, you know, we would have been much more supportive with her.
Once I reached out to my sister, it got a little better. Once I told my mother, it got a little better. The more I talked about it, I felt it coming off.
The healing is in me, and the healing and the journey can also be extended to others.
It's our community and our mental health.
Giving voice to what you're feeling is part of the healing. If you're strong enough to just open your mouth, that's all it takes.
And the most revolutionary and healing thing that Black people can do right now is to love one another.
It's time to share ourselves. Healing starts with us. A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Ad Council, and the Stay Strong Foundation.
You're listening to Truth Works Network, The Alpha Show.
Because there is something deep within our psyche, because of the way that we continue to be treated, that is making too many of us question whether or not God really does, in fact, love us equally.
And we thank you so much for being with us here at Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, and tonight our guest is attorney Ifeah Wangaza of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and she has been laying out to us the 24 points contained in a submission to the U.S., to the UN Human Rights Council that's going to be dealt with regarding U.S. performance in the area of human rights. And I think that it's real important for us to get involved around the global issue of human rights and how what the United States does as opposed to what it says it does. We have, you know, I don't think in this country that we have had a real engagement in terms of the public discourse, with the exception of Guantanamo Bay, with the exception of post-9/11 issues. We have forgotten about political prisoners that have been languishing. We have forgotten about COINTELPRO, that this country has never been held accountable, and it is time for us to get on the issue of human rights, because all the movements in this country are so isolated, they're so pitted in bipartisanship, they're so pitted in, they're really pitted in isolation. And if we begin to talk about police brutality, what happened with Oscar Grant, what happened at Gina, Louisiana, what happened at Katrina, what happened with the original peoples of America and the violations, if you'll recall, about 6 months ago, not Ruby Ridge, but there was another thing, Afia, that was going on, and there were U.S. Blackhawks descending on tribal grounds, actually landing, and I was listening to it live, landing into their honored ancestral lands where their ancestors were buried. They landed, didn't get out, and went back up, and nobody knows what that was all about. But tell us about the U.S. Human Rights Network priority in going to this conference, and whether or not, I mean, it's in Geneva, am I right?
That's correct. It is. It is in Geneva, and one of the things that is so significant is the fact that it's all public. The review will be a public interactive dialogue between Clinton and Holder and member and observer states of the council based on the reports that have been submitted by the U.S. government. And the U.S. government is supposed to submit its report to the Human Rights Council by the end of this month, or the 1st of September. And once it has been submitted, then it will be up on the, posted on the State Department's website. We will, of course, at the U.S. Human Rights Network, post it on our website, and it will be posted at the United Nations website, so that there is full opportunities for review. The United States, like every other country, is limited to only 20 pages, which is in and of itself a major accomplishment, because the wealthier countries, of course, can afford to just snow over the rest of the world in paper. But the United States is held to the same standard that every other country is held to, and that is that its report cannot exceed 20 pages. It engaged in a listening process around the country on which a part of its report is supposed to be based. It had hearings in the Bay Area of California.
So there were hearings.
Yes, there were hearings on the West Coast, Chicago.
This is what I'm not understanding. If you excuse me for interrupting.
Please.
But there were hearings in the Bay Area, but there weren't hearings in New York. How do people who are interested in becoming a supporter of, say, your organization know about these hearings?
Well, and that's one of the criticisms that we make, and that's one of the criticisms that we urge people to go to the Testify Project and complain about the process that was used for the hearing, because it was, as the State Department sponsored the hearings, and then everybody else had to scramble to access the hearings. So there's a question about how much citizen input there actually was, given the fact that they were not well publicized, that in large measure they were the sites were handpicked, and the witnesses were handpicked. In a lot of ways, they were very much like congressional hearings, except that they were sponsored by the State Department and they were in the various communities, usually on college campuses. So the Testify Project is the place to make that objection. And, again, that site is www.testfyproject.com. And there's a direct link at the U.S. Human Rights Network website. So it's limited in that regard. Now, in terms of becoming associated with the U.S. Human Rights Network, that's just a matter of going to the website and joining. So, you know, we're completely open to individuals and organizations. So that's easily done. And, of course, there is a biweekly newsletter that is sent out to the members. There are regular teleconferences which do two things. They update the membership on the issues of which the network is membership is working, and it educates and trains other members of the network who are interested in developing skills in a given area.
Yeah, because you do have grants for people who are interested in being trained.
That's right. And we're particularly concerned about getting more people of color, African people in particular, because we have been so left out of the this loop. You know, we've been encouraged to think that this is more white folks' business, and we need.
I was about to say the same thing.
Yeah. So that there's a particular emphasis on making sure that more of us are trained and involved and becoming active on a number of levels to be able to participate in the international community and the organizations and institutions, and also to be able to educate the rest of our community so that we, instead of being stuck with the notion of the U.S. Constitution as the standard, we raise the standard, as Malcolm X challenged us to do, to a human rights standard, and we know what those standards are. And the ones that the United States has signed on to and ratified, the ones that it needs to sign on to and ratify. The United States has not even signed on to the Convention for the Rights of the Child. And a part of the reason that it hasn't done that is because it doesn't want to be held to account on creating an environment where every child in this country has a real opportunity to realize his or her potential, to have food, clothing, shelter, access to health care, access to a real and meaningful education. Interestingly, the same issues for which the Black Panther Party was labeled enemy number one in this country when it was before, you know, you had the breakfast program in public schools, they were, you know, cooking eggs and serving bread.
That's right.
Kids
mm-hmm.
in the morning before they those kids went to school, or making sure that they had free eyeglasses if that was what mm-hmm. they needed, or initiating and launching the sickle cell anemia evaluations. That's why people are in prison. And that's why we live better today than we lived 50 years ago, not because the United States was so generous, not because we were so handsome or so pretty or so bright or so ambitious, but because there were people who were willing to put their lives and their liberty, and many died, their lives and their liberty on the line to mow down the barriers to our assertion and realization of our human rights as human beings. You know, Malcolm pointed out the difference between human rights and civil rights. Civil rights being those rights that we contract with the government to respect, like due process, like driving what the speed limit's going to be. But human rights are those rights that we have by virtue of the fact that we are human beings and are consistently deprived because in this, under the global system of white supremacy, we are not viewed as human beings. And we have to not only recognize our own humanity, but we have to assert it and demand that others force them, indeed, to respect it.
For those of you who are listening, we are tonight talking about taking the case of U.S. political prisoners and other U.S. human rights violations to the U.N. We're talking with attorney Afia Wangaza, who is one of the co-authors of a report submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Commission. And later this year, that report will be presented by attorney Wangaza in Geneva in the fall. And their goal is to outline the string of human rights abuses related to political prisoners and political repression in the United States. And it really is a stakeholders' report to the Universal Periodic Review, which is that mechanism by the UN to evaluate member states regarding their adherence or their negligence or their violations to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Afia, would you summarize for our audience the declaration? I know that on your, if for those of you who are following us on the U.S. Human Rights Network website, you can find a link to that declaration. But can you summarize it so people understand that they are, you know, it's real important, and we're going to be taking your calls, 405, I see you, 610, I see you, and we're going to come to your calls. But people really have to realize that when we are outraged by the murder of Oscar Grant or the police brutality in our communities or the failure of our school systems or the failure of our social service systems, the failure, the fact that 30 million children every night go to bed hungry in this country is a shameful violation not only of our own principles and laws, but it is a human rights principle and a human rights violation, and we have no reason to go anywhere to tell anybody about what they're doing, whether it's in Iraq, Afghanistan, Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, anywhere. And if you look at our prison industrial complex, that is simply nothing but a strategy of apartheid and another violation of repressive racial discrimination. Afia, we're going to go to our phones. 864, I'm coming at you. You're on our 405, you're on our common ground. I respect you, Hotep.
Hotep, and welcome to your guest.
Don, thank you very much from Oklahoma.
All right.
Yes,
thank you.
Yes, I have a question for you. You know, it appears to me that many of the political prisoners have been were victims of the FBI counterintelligence COINTELPRO, and couple that with what you have described or mentioned, white supremacy that we're enduring in worldwide, and the fact that after 9/11. We have implemented this nation has become, well, really before that, an aggressor nation, and have implemented the Patriot Act. I don't see any hope as far as getting any remedies for any kind of human rights. In fact, I think it's going, we're drowning. We're going down for the third time as far as trying to get some redress for human rights in this country and worldwide. There is no enforcement mechanism whereby a country such as this can be made to be accountable for its actions, and since it has such great power and influence. So, I mean, what are your suggestions for the average individual? I mean, how can we affect the what's happening and the direction that this is taking?
Well, the first thing, I think you've taken the first step by listening to this program tonight, and I dare say that this isn't the only program that you listen to, that you're probably a reader and a talker and a thinker, and being awake is the first step, because that is the thing that governments around the world least want. And this country has gone to great lengths to dumb down the general populace, to put people on the edge of survival, to the extent that the only thing that anybody thinks about or does anything about is how to acquire and maintain basic material survival. So you've manifest the level of resistance just in the fact that you are thinking about the question and that you're trying to get more information about it. The next step is to become involved in the process. We filed the reports with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights of the United Nations. And what our next step will be lobbying the member countries of the Human Rights Council to raise the issues that are listed in those 24 cluster reports. It's the countries actually that examine, that raise the question to the United Nations, to the United States. What we will be doing in Geneva is lobbying those countries to make sure that they ask the questions we want asked, and that when the outcome report is done, that those questions and those issues are incorporated and thus made a part of the standard by which the United States will be evaluated until they are those issues are addressed. What we are asking everybody else to do, in addition to educating themselves, is to educate other people and to begin to build units that will be in place after November 5th to make sure that the United States does what it is supposed to do, whether it becomes these issues are incorporated in the outcome document or not. We have a duty as a people who have benefited from the loss of liberty of political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exile to free them. We never hear anything about the Palestinians without hearing about their political prisoners held by the Israelis. We should be of that same quality and loyalty as well. The United States military doesn't leave a dead body on the ground. We have got over 100 people who have been in prison. Some people have died in prison. Marilyn Buck died in the past 10 days. Marilyn Buck was a North American anti-imperialist who helped to free Assata Shakur. We have people who are subject, who died, Merrill Africa, who have died as a result of medical neglect, which they all suffer, and in instances, people have actually died as a result of it. So we have a duty to get them out. So the next step is we educate ourselves, we organize ourselves, and we activate ourselves. On November 5th, we want people in front of embassies, consulates, federal buildings, demanding the commutation and the unconditional and immediate release of all U.S. political prisoners, all especially COINTELPRO civil rights era political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles. You know, the battle cry has been free them all. We're moving to the next level. We're more specific than that. We want their sentences commuted to time served, and we want them out, and we don't want any of these conditions about they can't talk to each other and they can't participate in political activity and blah, 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 blah. So
because when they get closer, when they get closer to a rational legal presentation, as in the case of Leonard Pelletier, then the strategy is for the government to have other prisoners engage them in some form of violence or get hurt or something, and they get put in solitary. So they have that shuts them up. We've had to understand that this is there is a war against these prisoners. I mean,
that's right.
When any time that there is a war cry on the outside for Mumia, for instance,
mm-hmm.
then he gets shut down.
Yes, but
you have
opposition and you have persecution directed toward the attorneys representing these prisoners, just like yourself. You have been persecuted. Lynn Stewart, she's in prison, and
that's
here
correct.
She is 60-something years old, 67, 68 years old,
70
years old. Who's coming to her aid? What homegrown organizations, or how are we going to get together with the leading organizations, minority organizations of whatever organizations that you have here, to present a united front to where in November they can show that, you know, at least get a snapshot of unity, and that's our problem. There's no unity. Everybody's walking in a different direction, allegedly claiming they're wanting the same thing, equitable rights in this country, which I just don't see it happening.
But Don, let me remind you that each time we think that we're going to have a little bit of space between the boot on our neck and our neck, this country does something. For instance, if you look in a good economic time during the Clinton administration, then they started messing with welfare reform,
right,
and repressing poor people with the extraction and the narrowing of financial assistance. So then we go into a tailspin.
I agree. It is a duty. I agree. I subscribe to the principle that each one reach one and then each one teach one. And then, you know, maybe we can bring about some awareness and just come together in some cohesive manner in that way, such as what we're doing tonight, and spreading it that way. I mean, it seems like that's the only thing that we have left right now.
That is a lot. You know, two quotes always come to my mind when I hear this the comments that you're making. The first one is Margaret Mead, the anthropologist, who said, "Never doubt that a small group of people, devoted people, will change the world. Indeed, that's the only way it's ever changed." And then there's the quote from Mahatma Gandhi, where he says, no matter, and I'm paraphrasing and probably badly to both of them, but in essence he says that no matter how small or insignificant it may seem, you must do it anyway. Because if it's established that when a butterfly on one side of the planet flaps its wings, it has an impact on the other side of the planet. So if a butterfly, by flapping its wings, can cause a vibration on the other side of the planet, just think that what we can do when we stand up straight, as Martin Luther King said, which prevents another from riding our back. I would also say that a part of what we need to educate ourselves about is the dynamics of movements. We have a TV mentality of movement. One of the most, in fact, the most powerful women's organization on the planet is Girl Scouts and Girl Guides. They are, you know, Girl Scouts and Girl Guides. Nobody thinks about the fact that if you go to a church throughout this country, in your community, other communities, in the basement or in some back room, there's five or six little girls and maybe one adult woman who's there with them. Sometimes you have the older girls, high school girls, who actually have to serve as the leaders, who are learning the ideology, the principles of girl being a Girl Scout or a Girl Guide. The most powerful, the largest, oldest, wealthiest women's organization in the world. The you know, it took 20 years to raise the March on Washington. That didn't just happen all of a sudden. Asa Randolph called for the March on Washington in the 40s. It took nearly 25 years before it actually happened. I worked for SNCC during the 60s. SNCC was one of the smallest organizations during that time. It was undoubtedly one of, if not the most impactful, in terms of moving us as a people to a human rights agenda.
Yes, that's
and
correct.
And asserting our right and raising the right of self-determination and creating the space for us to do it in Kwame Ture or Stokely Carmichael and Jamil Alameen, formerly known as H. Ralph Brown, popularization of the term Black Power. So we've got to recognize that it's not the big numbers. The big numbers, that's, you know, that's way, that's down the road, and it only happens periodically. It's the day-to-day grind of a handful of people that really make the difference and create the infrastructure for change. And that's what we're calling for. We're saying educate yourself about the UPR, educate yourself about political prisoners, and talk to family members, talk to friends. We hear this all the time, but it's the way things get done.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm going to get up the line, but what I hear you saying is that the link must not be unbroken. The chain must not be unbroken. Just like the chain of repression, the chain of white supremacy worldwide, I mean, that chain was started a long, long, long time ago.
Right.
And we must have the same intensity in dealing with the situation that we're talking about tonight also. So I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate Janice having you here to give us some insight into this situation. And, you know, I wish you well, and I'll be here supporting you, Attorney Juan Gaza. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you.
You've certainly pressed some issues that we definitely have to think about. We're going to move on to 610. You're on our common ground. I respect you, Hotep.
Yes, and I respect you and yours too, Brother Brock over here.
Brother Brock, welcome, welcome. How are you?
Fighting a little cold, but nevertheless, I'm doing all right, and I hope you can hear me well.
Well, it's good to have you with us. What's your comments and questions tonight?
I have a... three connecting questions on the mistreatment of the political prisoners. One question is: are there any politicians that are in support of your organization? Second question would be: is it the same as the waterboarding situation where the politicians did not tell the people that this was going on? They covered it up, and they do not admit that it's mistreatment of the prisoners, of the political prisoners, rather. So, and I'm trying to think of my third one, but those are the first two that right come to hand.
Well, let's see if we can get a response.
The first, with regard to supporting politicians, there are politicians who are offering support. What we have not tested the extent of that support. I think that it's going to be interesting to see when the U.S. delegation is put together who's going to be in that delegation and whether
who
or
decides
not
that, Afia?
That'll be decided by the White House and the State Department and the Department of Justice, since they are the three bodies that will be represented there. They, you know, the executive branch of the government is actually appearing, but they will, out of courtesy, invite the legislative branch of the government to be to participate. So you know there are going to be elected officials that are going to be involved. I would also point out that November 5th is Election Day, so there's a question, there's some limitations to the extent of who's running for re-election and who is available and who wants to be associated. I think that given the fact that it is a new vehicle and it's the United States' first participation and it's a part of the United States', as we call it, charm offensive to rebrand itself and to present itself as a diplomat as opposed to the thug that that it actually is, and that it certainly showed itself to be under the Bush administration, that there are going to want there are elected representatives who are going to want to be a part of it, and I would expect that the Congressional Black Caucus will be among them, as well as the Latino Caucus and the Progressive Caucus, and just the traditional human rights. You know, the U.S. House of Representatives has a human rights caucus. So members from that body will undoubtedly want to be represented as well.
Do you know some of the members of that caucus?
I don't have them off. I do not. I know that Tom Lantos, before he died, founded it and he led it. And abused it, used it as a shield for Zionist practices, human rights violations against the Palestinians. But it does still exist, and I fully expect that representatives from it will be a part of the delegation going to the Universal Periodic Review representing the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The second question was the torture cover-up, the continuing abuse and withholding of political prisoners, our brothers and sisters. That, you know, they don't have to cover it up because we don't show it up. You know, there are other communities, and the Puerto Ricans in particular, are vigilant about their political prisoners and prisoners of war. And when Hillary Clinton decided that she wanted to run for the Senate out of New York, they had to do business with the Puerto Ricans. And they released the Puerto Rican, 16 Puerto Rican independence fighters, some of whom who had used force in the course of their political activity. And I would take a moment to point out the levels of political, why we use the term political prisoners, prisoners of war, and exiles, because one of the things that the United States says, like every other government, is that they are not political prisoners, but that they are criminals. And, of course, the first question is what is a crime and who decides what is a crime and for what reason? One person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter, so or people's freedom fighter versus people's terrorist. So I urge us to keep that in mind when we hear the retort that they are not political prisoners, but that they're criminals. Political prisoners in the purest sense are those people who engaged in political activity which did not include the use of force and are incarcerated as a result of it. Prisoners of war are those who engaged in political activity which more likely than not did involve the use of force. And exiles are those people who, for various reasons, given their political activity, with or without force, decided that they would be more useful outside of the country and beyond the reach of the government. And an example of that, of course, is Assata Shakur, who's the longest standing exile that we have at this point in time, along with Nahanda Abiodun, both of whom are former Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army members. Others are scattered throughout the United States. We have people like Camille Alanine, Mamia Abu-Jamal, Matulu Shakur, who are in Supermax prisons, which are prisons that are designed to drive the person crazy. They are sensory deprivation chambers that were created by the Nazis for the purposes of driving people crazy. And it's a successful mechanism to do just that. There is little or no human contact. People are locked down 23 hours a day. If they're lucky, they get out an hour a day. They may get a shower once a week. Even when they visit with family, there is no physical contact. It's on a telephone between big glass. Their meals, they don't even have contact with the guards who hold them captive. Their meals are shoved through a metal door on a metal tray. So the government doesn't have to cover up their existence or their abuses, because we are so busy chasing the trinkets of this society that we have lost sight of our obligation and our own humanity, because it is inhumane on our part that we should allow them to be locked up for over 40 years and not even know their names, much less to take action to have them released unconditionally and immediately. So
thank you for that in-depth answer.
Well, I just posted the names of the members of the Human Rights Caucus, the Executive Committee, in our chat room, and they actually have renamed the caucus the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And McGovern, James McGovern, is the chair, is one co-chair, and Frank Wolf is another co-chair. And, you know, these people have got to be held accountable for what they do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And nobody.
Brother Brock, let me ask you a question about why you think, if you look at the framework under which the U.S. Human Rights Network has established both the cluster reports and established its work, why do you think that there are limited numbers of African Americans who are engaged in the connection between the human rights obligations under which this country has signed itself and that gap between what it actually does in practice? And what's your take about, I'm asking you three questions now, what's your take about the direction in which the Obama administration is going? Because I was very concerned when he did not appear before the council. Was it last year?
Yes, the review of WCAR.
Right.
Yeah.
So what's your take on that, Brother Brock?
prison?
Brother Brock, are you still with us? He dropped for some reason, but you can feel free. For those of you who would like to join in our conversation with Attorney Ithea Wangaza of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and I think this is a big deal. I mean, if I want to go Biden on you, you know what kind of deal I think it is. I think it's a real big deal. Our number is 347-838-9852 to join in on our conversation. I hope you hung up the phone by mistake. I was asking you questions because I think it's real critical for us to understand. I think the quote that you offered, Ithea, in regard from Malcolm X, is so important for us to understand that all these movements are really, every time you turn around, there's a new movement, the Tea Party movement, the movement. They're all manufactured for us to keep our heads, our focus off of the real issue. Brother Brock, I hope you call us back. It's 347-838-9852. I'm looking for your reconnect. But, Ithea, let's talk a little about the role that, in regard to housing, in regard to childhood protections, in regard to police brutality. There's Brother Brock. Thank you for calling us back. You're on the air, Brother Brock. Thank you. Did I hang up on you? You hung up on yourself.
No, I was thinking that opening the line for the next caller, so I hung up the phone. But if you did have a question, I would like to.
No, we wanted
it.
I really wanted to get your input about those questions about our engagement.
I think, because I almost alluded to it in the chat room earlier, that issues that deal with people of color, our president seems to shun and shy away from. So as we look at the political prisoners, and when the guest host lady mentioned the different names, especially when you talked about the Black Panther Party, and then Mumia Abdul-Jamal, who is a part of the MOVE organization here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, people of color, that lets me know that the president does not want to touch that issue, so I don't see any light at the end of the tunnel under this administration for actually helping these people get any justice.
I think that it is cause for concern. However, it's beyond his what he wants or what he doesn't want, and if this is a different point in time. I think I mentioned earlier that that I thought that we're kind of where we were 50 years ago when African countries were emerging, and the United States wanted to develop relationships. You know, and there was the balance, the fight between the Soviet Union and the United States for this, as they put it, spheres of influence, and which countries were going to be picked up given after they got their independence. And the United States wanted to and did take advantage of the fact that it had not been a hands-on colonial power, as had the French and the British and the Portuguese and the Belgians and so on and so forth. And we're kind of at that point again where the court of public opinion is of extraordinary significance, because the goal is to rebrand and to reinvent the United States in the eyes and the mind of the rest of the world, especially that of Africa. For instance, the AFRICOM, the United States has still not been able to find a permanent home to put down major military bases for AFRICOM in Africa. Now, people say that it's not necessary to have a landmass, to have a base for AFRICOM, that given all the battleships and all of that, it can be offshore, and that Djibouti is close enough, and Dubai, so that advantage can be taken of those locations, and therefore it's not relevant. However, remember that one of the first things that is constantly called for whenever there is a question about relationships and how issues are going to be addressed in any situation, the first thing is we hear is we need human intelligence. We need people on the ground. They can't run everybody through the embassy. So that means that the United States has got to win, as Ronald Reagan put it, the hearts and minds of the people. And how do you win the hearts and minds of the people? You present yourself with clean hands. You present yourself in a manner that is going to result in people suspending criticism. And what better than to have a person of African descent to advance a white supremacist agenda? We are the ones who have to be there to say, this is white power in blackface, and you cannot be fooled by the fact that the person is a person of African descent. It's global neocolonialism. So therefore, the United States has an interest in being able to put some kind of spin and some kind of explanation on the questions that we are raising. And a part of that requires it to behave in a certain kind of way. Also is the shaming factor. Shaming is one of the most effective international tools available. It is the reason that Amnesty International received a Nobel Prize. You know, that's another very powerful, small organization where across this country you can go into church basements, community centers, bookstores, and you may see five or six people sitting there for an hour writing letters to government saying, stop force-feeding this person. They don't want that kind of publicity. The United States doesn't want that kind of publicity. We're organizing cells across this country for the purposes of shaming the United States. And don't think that the United States is not beyond shame. The United States government is like every other government on the planet. First of all, it wants to be well thought of. Secondly, it wants to be able to trade in human relations across the planet and to be able to continue to say to other governments, be like us, even if it's be like we say be and not like we are. We African people have the duty to be there to say you are not what you say you are, and we're not going to be quiet unless and until you are. And the first step in that direction is meeting your international human rights obligations. Janet, you asked about the various standards. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Eleanor Roosevelt gets a lot of credit for having shepherded its development, is a higher form of the U.S. Constitution. It is, in fact, a human rights document, which requires that the government have a meaningful, substantive social contract with its citizenry, including to the point that the government has to make sure that citizens actually have access to all technology, not just learning how to read and write and count.
Athea, we're running out of time, and I do want to say good evening to Brother Brock, and thank you for, I think your questions are right on point. I think they raise our obligations and our duties in a way that makes it pretty simple, that everywhere we go, we have to be raising the issues of human rights and framing every other issue, protest in our community within that framework. Brother Brock, thank you so much for being with us. We certainly could spend a great deal. We could spend a number of hours talking about this issue. And Athea, you are just so good at laying it out, and I really, really do appreciate the way in which you've been able to lay it out. Now, for those people who are listening who want to become part of the work that the U.S. Human Rights Network is doing, can they just simply go and sign up and say, hey, I want to be a part of this?
Yes.
I want to become a trainer. I want to become an activist in my own community.
Absolutely. Go to the Human Rights Network's website at www.
Which I just posted.
Oh, great. And participate in the Testify Project. There's a link at the website for that as well. There's a link on the UPR. That site.
We've been posting that throughout the program. And one of the things that we're going to do is feature the Testify Project on Wednesday night on TruthWorks, and we hope that you'll join us on I'm going to put together a documentary of the testimonies that are at Testify, the project website. Attorney Athea Wangaza, thank you so much.
We wish you
well in November in Geneva, and we'll be posting and blogging about the report submitted, the reports on repression and political prisoners in the U.S. and U.S. human rights violations for the coming months.
Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you for the work that you do on our behalf.
And your extension of it, because, you know, if it doesn't get out into the community, it doesn't mean a whole lot.
Exactly.
So thank you.
Okay, and you have a great weekend. Thank you all for being with us here at Our Common Ground tonight as we've been talking about taking U.S. human rights issues to the UN and making our case. I'm Janice Graham, and you've been listening to Our Common Ground. Thank you for being with us. Hotep, I respect you. Have a great weekend. See you next week, 10 p.m. right here at Our Common Ground. Thank you for joining us at Our Common Ground. Join us next week, Saturday night, open mic, 10 p.m. I'll be listening for you.